This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you for a special edition of the WBAI during the WBAI Fund Drive, Tuesday, May 24th. We're glad to be here and with you and in this new time slot for today to make our contribution to WBAI. We're changing gears from what you've been listening to so far today. Today, for our new premium for WBAI Fund Drive, we have a remarkable presentation made by Ralph that had everyone on their feet, listening attentively, applauding, exclaiming, and wanting more. This is 9/11 and
the Terrorist State.
The Terrorist State. State, a presentation by Ralph at the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11 Phase 2 that was held in Toronto May 25th through 30th, 2004. If you weren't there, this is a golden opportunity to have this two-CD presentation. Included in the CD for your gift of $100 to WBAI, it's over 2 hours. We have over a one-hour presentation by Ralph, 9/11 and State Terror, and then a remarkable format. There's a panel of three people who discuss with Ralph his presentation, and then the session is opened up for questions and answers from the floor. And if any of you have not been at one of Ralph's lectures, it's during the dynamic questions and answer period that Ralph even continues and expands upon whatever his presentation is. So the number to call, 212-209-2950, for your opportunity to have for your very own 9/11 and State Terror. Ralph, do you want to say something before we...
Well, I was thinking, Maya, as we go into this issue of the constant preparation for the next staged event. Last night I was watching CNN, and lo and behold, there's a special segment on something called Terror Research, Inc., which is a private corporation that is staging terror attacks on the United States, rehearsing them at a military base in North Carolina. And the operation is called Operation Mirror Image. And what this private corporation contracted to the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Pentagon is doing, Maya, they're having people training as terrorists. They're actually wearing Islamic garb, and they are replicating what they purport to be the practice of fundamentalists. They read the Quran. They are set up as the demonized figures of the Arab East, and there they are carrying out assassinations and biological attacks, and the game plan is to train police forces across the United States in these simulated terror operations in which the authorities are themselves assuming the role of terrorists, nominally to prepare for a counter-terrorist operation in city after city, but it's fairly transparent here as to what we're dealing with.
So for your health and well-being, listen to 9/11 and the Terrorist State, and most of all, contribute to WBAI and spread the word. Get this premium and distribute it to your friends, your family, and your colleagues. So, Michael, before time passes any further, let's go to the beginning of 9/11 and State Terror by Ralph Schoenman.
I want to thank the organizers of the International Inquiry here in Canada for allowing me to come and speak before you. Express my appreciation to Ian Woods and to Michelle Chosadovsky and all of those who have worked so hard to make this a reality over this series of days. If you've looked at your newspapers today, I'm sure you could not fail to note the headlines, Al-Qaeda plans to hit U.S. hard, two Canadians amongst list of terror suspects. And inevitably and inexorably, we are, of course, informed that these putative suspects are linked to none other than Mohammed Atta, and the means through which their presumptive whereabouts were determined by what was referred to by Robert Mueller and John Ashcroft as an increase in the chatter. Now, they seem to be very skillful at determining the amount of chatter without ever being able to locate its origins, notwithstanding their echelon and their hardware and their electronic spying and their satellite apparatus, which enables them to determine these things very easily. They fail to find the chatterers. And indeed, the terrorists, as they're referred to, are not easily discerned. I have some special intelligence for you as to what allows that to be possible. The reason is that the terrorists actually look rather like George Bush, Richard Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, and so on, except that for the most part up to now, they have not been so readily identifiable. I think we're in the process of changing that. And indeed, tonight I want to, in the time allotted, to address some of the issues pertaining to what is a false flag operation and how the events of 9/11 are paradigmatic in that they reveal the hand of the state and of structured power in their unfolding and in their meaning and in their significance and in their import for all of us. But frankly, I think it's essential for us all that we do not have to reinvent the wheel each time that those who have control of our society visit upon us an event which is essential to the perpetration of yet another crime and yet another predation upon peoples in the world. I'll just take a moment to mention the fact that I had the pleasure and opportunity of working over a decade with Bertrand Russell during the years that I lived in London. Now, Bertrand Russell was raised by his grandfather when his grandfather was in his 80s. His grandfather, Lord John, had actually introduced the Reform Act of 1832 and had visited Napoleon at Elba. And Bertie used to say, history stops in 1815. After that, it's gossip, family gossip. I suggest that we need to recapture that history and an understanding of its significance for the events of today. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels in the Communist Manifesto wrote that the bourgeoisie has at last, since the establishment of modern industry and of the world market, conquered for itself in the modern representative state exclusive sway politically. The executive of the modern state is but a committee for managing the common affairs of the entire bourgeoisie, they wrote. And they stated it as well, that this new capitalist order has resolved personal worth into exchange value and in place of the numberless indefeasible chartered freedoms has set up that single unconscionable freedom, free trade, in one word, exploitation, veiled by religious and political illusion, substituting naked, shameless, direct, and brutal conquest. Richard Goodwin, who was a young man of 28, a functionary in the State Department during the Kennedy administration, wrote not so long ago on the 8th of February an article in the New York Times called Making the Facts Fit the Case for War. And he opens this piece as follows. In 1846, President James Polk announced that Mexican troops had fired on American soldiers on American soil, and he took the country to a war that gained it California, New Mexico, Arizona, amputating a substantial part of Mexico at the time. And Goodwin says, was the disputed soil ours? No. Did Polk distort the information he had? Yes. He wanted the territory, and he needed a war to get it. He goes on to describe how, when at the age of 28, he was in the presence of the National Security Council for an operation intended to take over Cuba and defeat and destroy and remove from power the Cuban Revolution and Fidel Castro. And he describes how he was in the presence of a series of generals and officers, and Richard Bissell, the legendary figure and the man responsible for a series of predations and covert operations and special operations and eliminations, assassinations, and so forth. At one point, Bissell turned to a general sitting beside him and said rather calmly, "Don't we have an NIE on this?" referring to a classified national intelligence estimate indicating that the U.S. would meet with rather little opposition in Cuba. The general nodded. And Goodwin comments, of course, that NIE did not exist. So we see that the nature of our structure of power is such that events of this nature are handled in camera. It was the former president of Avis and American Express, Robert Townsend, who in his book Up the Organization described how the number of people who control what he called the commanding heights of the economy of the society are approximately 5,000. They average about 14 corporate directorships per person. They integrate the banking and corporate hegemony over capital. And the state is but the vehicle for both subsidizing their needs and imposing their rule. He said, they look upon this country as their own whorehouse, and for them every president is their private towel boy. New York Times tells us that about 1% now of the population owns and controls some 90% of the national wealth. So if we look back upon our history, and we examine the process through which power has been concentrated and consolidated, and the nature of its reach, and the compulsions that prevail upon capital in seeking control of markets to impose its hegemony and to extract cheap labor and free resources belonging to others, it is a familiar and sordid and constant legacy and tale. "We must have the Chinese market or we shall have a revolution," proclaimed Senator Frye, 1891. Quincy Adams used the Christian principles in the expression of the same thing. "The moral obligation upon which our relations are based is exclusively and entirely the Christian proverb, 'Love thy neighbor as thyself.' The Chinese," he added, "are not Christian. They do not consider that they should love their neighbors as themselves. They reject the commercial principle. They will not accept our control. It is high time that this outrage against human decency was ceased." President McKinley, "The Lord has said that the United States has the duty of educating and elevating the Philippines into Christian civilization and by the grace of God to do all that we can for our brother nation for whom Christ also died." And he adds, "The Philippines are ours forever, and right behind them is the immense Chinese market. We shall not leave either one." Well, every major spokesperson for capital has articulated these themes, whatever nominal political association in the complex of political parties owned and possessed and represented and dominated by capital in our society. Woodrow Wilson was equally explicit. "If we do not enforce our commerce abroad, we cannot have any liberty in this country. It is a luxury we cannot afford. Our industry is at the point where it collapses. Unless we have control of the world market, we must have foreign domination." Herbert Hoover, "Foreign control is more important for us to ensure the stable and normal functioning of our capitalist economy, a greater importance than home consumption." And Franklin Roosevelt. Here is the president of the National Industrial Conference Board, Virgil Jordan, December 10, 1940. "Whatever the outcome of this war, we have taken the road of imperialism on an economic plane, as on all other planes of life. Yes, some fear this word imperialism, so well known, and to some menacing. Most people prefer to mask this under the more acceptable formulation of defense of a Western Hemisphere. But we have no choice but to continue on this road as we have for the past century, beginning with the seizure of the continent, proceeding to the annexation of Cuba and the Philippines. This empire sees its prospects beyond the southern part of the hemisphere and expanding west of the Pacific. The scepter must fall in the hands of the United States." Every major spokesperson articulating this theme as the defining element of imperial policy. And if we look carefully at this structure of economy at the height of the New Deal in the middle of the second term. The rate of unemployment in the United States was exactly comparable to that of Herbert Hoover under the Great Depression. The percentages employed in the arms industry were relatively small. And within 18 months, this was reversed. With massive armament, the percentages of unemployment now fell to what they had been in military employment prior, and those of the unemployed in percentage were now engaged in the arms industry, capitalism addicted to military production like an addict needs his fix, and in ever-increasing doses. And that is the process that drives forward the national security apparatus that defines power and determines policy. Every single foray has been characterized by events analogous to those of 9/11. Remember the Maine? They blew up a ship in Havana Harbor and imputed it to the Spanish to provide the opportunity and the pretext for seizing Cuba and the Philippines, unfolding the first truly genocidal war, taking the lives of nearly 3 million Filipinos. And World War I itself, through the sinking of the Lusitania, as Colin Simpson so amply documented in his book, followed a process through which that Lusitania was signaled not only to German submarines, but to the insurance companies by the owners and by American and British intelligence at the time. And so with Pearl Harbor. And so, indeed, with the Korean War, as I.F. Stone so well documented in his book, The Hidden History of the Korean War. And then we have Operation Northwood, 1962, in which the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lyman Limnitzer, in the councils of the National Security Council, laid forth a plan on which every member of the Joint Chiefs signed off, which called for the hijacking of airplanes and flying them into buildings in Washington and in Miami, the random killing of U.S. citizens and civilians, of course, in cities in the United States, anticipating the blowing up of the rocket carrying John Glenn astronaut and imputing all of this victims to be smashed, crushed, exploited, conquered, and brushed aside. Since 1964, every United States administration has prepared for direct seizure of Arab oil. Here's how it was described by a Pentagon analyst in commentary, Oil, the Issue of American Intervention, January 1975, without intervention, there is the distinct prospect of an economic and political disaster bearing more than a superficial resemblance to that of the 1930s. And then they go on to describe the Arab shoreline of the Gulf and that of Mesopotamia as a new El Dorado awaiting its conquistador. A rapid deployment force, a plan embraced by every administration and codified by Jimmy Carter on August 25, 1977, in a secret presidential directive, PD-18, calling for a rapid intervention force of 100,000 troops to seize directly Arab oil in the Middle East. By 1979, Lawrence Mosher formulated it as the 100,000-man quick strike force consisting of multiple divisions deployable. And then he states, for the Pentagon and defense officials, we need a real boogeyman to come in and have to be stopped before we can talk of our quick strike force. It may turn out that boogeyman may not be defined the same in Arabic as in English. So I insist, therefore, that we look at these events in their proper context as the continuation of a species of rule that requires not just assembling, but the perpetuation of staged events. Now, many of us have been up against the claim and the charge that what we are doing is indulging in what is called conspiracy theory, right? There's a certain irony about that, because the most frequently invoked juridical tool for prosecutors at every judicial level in the United States, municipal, county, state, and federal, is that of conspiracy. Conspiracy to defraud, RICO, conspiracy to do this, conspiracy to do that. The only conspiracy in which they have vanishing little interest is that of our rulers. And indeed, they fail to understand because they choose not to. It's what the Jesuits call invincible ignorance. They know, but they prefer not to know. That power proceeds on a completely closed and clandestine basis when it is illicit, when it is concentrated, when it is concealed, when it doesn't flow through the formal institutions, as is the overwhelmingly documented character and case of power in American society, and in North American society, I should add. Now, in that context, I have to say that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, those who rule in our society, those who had obtained over $9.3 trillion for the Pentagon in a space of 40 years, more than the combined value of everything produced in the society, taken together, were confronted by the absence of a rationale for soliciting and for securing trillions of dollars for the defense apparatus, the maw of imperial control, and that industrial compounded structure of capital that is wholly dependent upon it. And there you have the genesis of the category of terror as a substitute and a replacement for the communist menace and that of subversion and the menace of the Soviet Union, the ideological integument, the category of terror. And it doesn't arise out of nothing. Instructively, a particular individual, a young man at the time of 28, named Benjamin Netanyahu, was induced by George Shultz and Bush to organize a series of conferences on the category and the prospect of terror. And by the way, the Israeli weekly Haier disclosed that Benjamin Netanyahu operated under four different names and four different social security numbers for the Central Intelligence Agency: Benjamin Netanyahu, Benjamin Netai, John J. Sullivan, and John J. Sullivan Jr. Yes. A series of conferences on the prospect of terror. They were held in Washington, D.C. They were held in Jerusalem and in Tel Aviv with Secretary of State George Shultz, Jack Hemp, Senators Alan Cranston, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, FBI Director William Webster, Jean Kirkpatrick, Moshe Arendt, who served as Minister of Defense, Yitzhak Rabin, then Minister of Defense, and replicated again in Washington with Bush Sr. present, with Joint Chiefs of Staff in tow. The category of terror. And indeed, at that time, a document was prepared by the Mossad, a figure named Oded Yinon, called A Strategy for the 1980s, which stipulated that the task before those who rule was to fragment each Middle Eastern country, notably Arab states, in their turn, into their ethnic and religious components, replicating what Abba Iban called the millet system of the Ottoman Empire. And they spelled it out. Iraq was high amongst the targets, but not Iraq alone. Iraq was considered a target of opportunity because of the importance of its oil. But this was not confined to Iraq, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Egypt, all in their turn were to be targeted and indeed fragmented and dissolved as a functioning state, because imperialism had reached the point, it was discerned, where they could no longer afford the comprador elements who engaged in flight capital. They needed and they were determined to impose direct seizure of resources and direct military rule. And they required a rationale for all of that. It's interesting, you know, on the first anniversary of 9/11... a series of articles occurred, one by Richard Bernstein in the New York Times, explaining that the linchpin event for 9/11 was that of 1993. And another by Bill Keller, but a few days later, called The Sunshine Warrior, which described how, at a meeting at the War College with the Army Chief of Staff and General Eric Shinseki as such, young Pentagon analyst Wolfowitz, it was disclosed, had directed a secret assessment in 1979, a dozen years before Desert Storm, then orchestrated by a series of organizations, the American Enterprise Institute, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, the Defense Policy Board, all of that apparatus of the Likud wing of the Israeli state, now central to the designs of imperialism, the cat's paw instrument in the Arab East, now at the center of imperial policy. the category of terror. Well, you know, in 1993, we did indeed have what might in some respects be called a dry run. And even today, in the Toronto Star, these invented figures who are again associated with the demonic Mohammed Atta are said to have had their instruction not only through Mohammed Atta's involvement in the events of 9/11, but in the precedent of the World Trade Center events of 1993. Well, let's look at that briefly for one moment, because it indeed is a linchpin event. Imad Ali Salem is the person who went into the mosque of the blind Egyptian cleric Sheikh Rahman in Brooklyn and in New Jersey, and he solicited the presence at meetings of young Arab men at these mosques on a need-to-know basis. And he proceeded to make a series of proposals which involved bringing things to station points and safe houses, and he indeed would supply what he called the necessaries. They were explosives. And then he expanded upon his proposals to include what are now called the landmark events: the blowing up of the Brooklyn Bridge, the Holland Tunnel, the Lincoln Tunnel, the George Washington Bridge, the Statue of Liberty, the United Nations itself. Brothers and sisters, Imad Ali Salem was a high-level operative in the Federal Bureau of Investigation and had a long history both in that capacity and in Egyptian intelligence. He wore a wire to every one of these meetings, and he made a transcript of every single recorded meeting he had. And those transcripts were deposed in the New York office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, 50 file boxes for 6 months antecedent to the event. The person who organized the safe house and the rider rental van, it turns out, is a character named Guzi Hadass, a Mossad operative. And Matara, the Mossad and Shin Bet Israeli intelligence communication network, disclosed that these events were in preparation with prior knowledge by both Shin Bet and Mossad for some time previous. Confirmed in Haaretz, 1993 was indeed a predicate. False flag operations, the paradigm of what became 9/11. Well, we've had some discussion tonight about some of those who've been accused: Mohammed Atta, Abdelaziz Alamari, Saeed Al-Ghamhi. On September 15, 2001, we're told that these people had particular schooling. Their base of operation was the Pensacola Naval Station, which was their address. Indeed, they were at Brooks Air Force Base and Maxwell Air Force Base and at the Defense Language School in Monterey, California. They had high-level security clearance. They were operatives, Newsweek and the Washington Post. Mohammed Atta has been presented so often, and yet, when we look carefully, we ask the question, who indeed is he? Newsweek also carried an article in the aftermath of the events of September 11th, in which his father, who was a noted lawyer in Cairo, described how he spoke with his son on September 12th. And he describes him as somebody who had never been in any trouble with the authorities, but on the contrary, had always worked in close conjunction with them. And then in a later interview, he added that his son had been killed by the Mossad, sadly, set up and taken out. Well, we learned that Mohammed Atta and his colleagues were being tracked as early as 1998 by German intelligence. When they were in Hamburg, every movement they made was monitored. And Andreas von Bülow has given particular detail about how this was done. The Germans were tracking these people, but it seems they were doing more than tracking them, because Mohammed Atta and his colleagues were working for an elite U.S. and German exchange program, which was disclosed not only in the Chicago Tribune, but by Daniel Hopsicker. An operation in which the controlling figures were those in the Rockefeller Foundation, Henry Kissinger, and so on. These are intelligence operations, and these are false flag figures, and these are hired hands. A U.S. operation that is transparent. But then look at the figure that has been presented to us, this determined and humorless and religiously fanatic Mohammed Atta, who appears in Shuckam's bar, where it's disclosed in Newsweek that he had been noted for doing lines of coke and for showing up frequently drunk and doing Stolichnaya and orange juice. And there, in this particular well-witnessed sequence at Shuckam's bar, rather drunk, he gets into a pissing contest with those present in the bar. And at one point, he begins to curse in Arabic, as Newsweek describes it, rather blasphemously, the equivalent of "fuck God." And he proclaims, "Well, I work for American Airlines, and I'm a pilot with credentials, and what makes you think I can't pay my way in this bar?" And that is the pattern. The figures who we are presented with, when you examine them with any particularity, all show the hand of intelligence. BBC had reported that hijacked suspects are alive and well.
You've been listening to 9/11 and State Terror, the remarkable presentation by Ralph Schoenman at the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11 Phase 2 that took place in Toronto May 25th to 30th last year. This is a full-hour presentation followed by a panel discussion and a period of question and answer from the audience. All this engaging Ralph Schoenman on the structure of power, as he says in this portion, illicit, concentrated, and concealed, except for the dynamism and the research of Ralph and his remarkable presentation. The way he has of bringing it all together, tying in 9/11 to the events of the Spanish-American War and history before then, how it all fits in with the structure of power and the nature of capitalist rule in America, why it is so important to each and every one of us. For your contribution to WBAI to sustain your station, your listener station, that brings to you programs such as Taking Aim, $100 contribution for 9/11 and State Terror. Ralph?
You know, Maya, as we...
Ralph, I'm sorry. The phone number first, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Ralph?
Every time that we try to talk about the structure of power and the way in which policy unfolds, of course, as I mentioned in the talk, Maya, we're labeled with the term conspiracy theorist, and it is the case that history is not driven by conspiracy, but it is also true that those in power function and act in conspiratorial fashion. Because obviously, brothers and sisters, when they decide to make war, when they want to exploit resources, when they want to grab oil, when they need a rationale for permanent war and massive armament, they don't come out and say, we want to grab the oil fields and we're going to create an incident in order to justify it. Those things are done in concert, and by definition, power that is concealed, power that is concentrated, and power that does not proceed through any legitimate process must function in a conspiratorial fashion. And I think it's important for us to get beyond the attempts to label. Of course, another point to make about this, think about the ultimate conspiracy theory, that this handful of operatives scattered across the world have a greater capacity than the state power of the Soviet Union and 50,000 hydrogen bomb missiles to terrorize the United States. We've got to break through the ideological nonsense with which we are flooded and with which we are cowed and intimidated, and that's what is so essential about the programming that WBAI facilitates and permits. There would be no Taking Aim outside of WBAI and Free Speech Radio, and that kind of process through which we can research and analyze and mobilize has to have an outlet. Brothers and sisters, it needs a way of reaching out to you, and we need you to maintain that programming, and that's why we ask your support, and we ask you to call in your pledge and to get the data, because you'll see on this CD, not only the presentation, but you, Michel Chossadovsky and the various activists and scholars at this event, they don't take anything at face value, including what we say to each other. It's a very intensive and dynamic and analytic and spirited exchange that illuminates, in my judgment. I found it stimulating, and I think you're going to enjoy it too, and it gives you a framework. In my judgment, it gives you a means of putting these events together and connecting the dots.
And this is a program that you can't hear only once. Ralph's programs and Taking Aim are very dense, and you will not find this presentation on our website, www.takingaim.info. Only place that you're going to have it is with your contribution to WBAI, 212-209-2950. I'd like to bring up the issue of censorship because it's so important to the fact that WBAI is uncensored radio. Today there was a little piece in the newspaper about how Bill Maher had made a remark on his program about the inability of the U.S. Army to recruit. They are 42-43% down in their recruitment goals. And he had made a remark, and immediately a congressman came forward and said, Bill Maher should be put up for treason. What he said was a treasonous remark. And Bill Maher, instead of supporting the importance of free speech and the ability of each and every one of us, he conceded and gave his applause for the U.S. military.
Well, what he said was, Maya, that he backtracked totally. Maher had made a comment to the effect that the Army was running out of, what's the first one, young woman, England, who,
Lindy England.
They run through their patsies, and they were running out of people to recruit. Whereupon a congressman is seriously putting forth legislation to bring him up on charges of treason, and mayor's pusillanimous response to that, brothers and sisters, would say, nobody exceeds my admiration for the young men and women who are serving our country in Iraq. Talk about spinelessness and crawling and craven capitulation. Instead of taking it to them like George Galloway did in the Senate when he said, you're not only a bunch of liars, but the treason starts at the top, Mayor Caves. Well, that's what you get when you're on a commercially sponsored network like HBO or what have you, because it's, after all, corporate-controlled media. Even a putative liberal like Mayor has to capitulate when the foot is put to the metal here by the authorities.
212-209-2950. The volunteers in the pledge room, we appreciate all their assistance, and they like to be kept busy. They come into WBAI and they want to hear from you. And we've prepared this along with Bonnie Faulkner of KPFA's Guns and Butter, where everyone was thrilled, remarkably thrilled, and they couldn't have enough phones at KPFA to keep the lines open. And that's what we expect from our precious and devoted and loyal listeners. All of you, if this is the first time you have tuned in and heard Taking Aim, we broadcast weekly from 5 to 6, and it is only for the good spirit and the importance and your coming forward and saying we want the truth and we want analysis and we want to be empowered. And that's why we bring programs such as 9/11 and State Terror to you. 212-209-2950. It is only with the understanding, the ability to put together facts. Facts are of no use unless they come together in a coherent analysis, and then once we have that analysis, when we take action. But it is important to understand. 212-209-2950. Your collaboration in this process is with your contribution to WBAI. It is your gift to yourself. 212-209-2950. Ralph?
Well, I don't know if it's appropriate to say this, Maya, but I think it's okay. You know, brothers and sisters, when we were making this 9/11, the terrorist state presentation as a premium on KPFA in Berkeley, the phones were ringing off the hook, and we raised $10,000 just in the first hour. And I hope we can match it. We want to do that for WBAI. You know, let me be candid about this. Maya and I, we produce the program, we research the program, and we take the time to put it forward in the studio and engineer it and get it out to you. We do this for nothing. This is not for money, brothers and sisters. We're raising money to keep this kind of programming alive. We want that money to go to keeping WBAI on the air and to keeping Taking Aim a premier show on WBAI. So what we're asking you to do is not, you're not supporting us in any personal way. That's not what we're after here. We're trying to maintain the ability to do programming like this, to keep the station going and to keep taking aim front and forward on the Pacifica network. So please, support the kind of programming that 9/11 and the terrorist state represents, the information that we've been assembling over a period of years now, and please call in your pledge.
212-209-2950. Each time we have a fund drive, it's an opportunity to find out who is listening to WBAI, and it's amazing the broad reach of this station, the incredible reach into Connecticut, into New York, New York, the five boroughs, and then beyond in New Jersey and in the Long Island and all the way up into New York State, and as well through the wonderful work of the stream on the website and how the WBAI website has become a homepage for so many. We have people listening throughout the world. If you are in England or even in Thailand or wherever, you can contribute to WBAI during this fund drive via the secure website, www.wbai.org. If you're in Oregon, as many of our listeners are, or you're in the state of Washington, or you're in California, or in Texas, or Louisiana, pick up the phone. This is the time to make a long-distance call, 212-209-2950.
And Maya and Ralph, what you are offering to the listeners is 9/11 and state terror. It's a 2-CD set, I do believe, for a pledge of $100. Is that correct?
Yes, thanks for reminding everyone.
Right. Oh, and folks can pledge using their Visa card, their MasterCard, or American Express. We have something called electronic funds transfer. They can do that as well. Or they can send a check or a money order to us here at WBAI. The phones are ringing right now as we speak, Maya. 212-209-2950. This is a special edition of Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. As Maya said a moment ago, they're on every week. This is not their usual time slot. They're usually on 5 p.m. in the afternoon. This is not their usual audience, and you may be, for the very first time, be hearing Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. If this is the first time you're hearing this information and you would like to hear it and you'd like to hear more of it, please call and support this station, because this is a listener-sponsored radio station. This is a commercial-free radio station. We could only bring you this kind of programming with the support of the listeners, because corporations, the major corporations, will not support this. And in fact, they want this kind of information to disappear. They want you to be caught up with buying BMWs and other kinds of frivolous items. They don't want you to have information, and that's what Ralph and Maya do. They arm you with information. You may not agree with everything that they are saying, but it is out there. They put it out there for you, and you can agree with it or disagree with it, but the fact that listener-sponsored radio is here, is there for you to make your own decision, because I would dare say if it wasn't for them, you wouldn't have some of this information. Sure, some of this information is available on the internet, but it is condensed by Ralph and Maya here for you on Taking Aim. So do call now with your pledges of support for Taking Aim, 212-209-2950 for a pledge of $100. We'll send you Ralph and Maya has put together this package, 9/11 and State Terror, a 2-CD set, as well as your subscription in WBAI. Maya?
212-209-2950. Thanks so much, Michael. Each and every day, Michael G. Haskins is at the controls and facilitates and enables you to get the programming. We must maintain the infrastructure of WBAI. Ralph?
Well, I wanted to point out that you mentioned the radio streaming and the miracles of the Internet and the web. Yeah, we have listeners, brothers and sisters, from China and Iran and Norway and Cuba, and we hear from them. But I take particular pride in the fact, and I know Maya does as well, that we have a large listenership amongst prisoners, the prisoners of New Jersey, the prisoners of New York. We have constant communication from prisoners, and we send them our CDs, and we send them our material, and we don't charge them for it. And it's that audience, the dispossessed and the exploited, the criminalization of poverty that is reflected in the fact that one out of three black male youth are in prison, on parole, or in the judicial process. This is a targeted victimization of the most vulnerable in our society, and our programming is designed to, it's a defense instrument. Those who are most in need of defense and of the ability to fight back and to be possessed of the information and the analysis and the means of organization that will allow us to build that resistance that is necessary for all of us to survive. We take pride in the fact that we have a prisoner audience as well. We take pride in the fact that that young people who are working in parking lots in the dead of winter gather around their drums with a fire in them to listen to Taking Aim. We hear from them all the time. That is our mission, brothers and sisters, to mobilize the many, to reach out to those who are most exploited and most dispossessed, what we think is the real audience and the targeted audience for a station like WBAI, and it's certainly the audience we intend and we expect to address on Taking Aim. That's why, in particular, your support is not only for WBAI and for Taking Aim, but for those of us who need the information to survive. Those of us who need the analysis to prepare themselves for struggle, please join in that effort, participate in that work, and support Taking Aim in the programming to which you are listening.
212-209-2950. Well said, Ralph. And that is why in programs such as 9/11 and State Terror, Ralph gives you historical perspective. When events unfold, such as the events of 9/11, people look at what is taking place in the immediate moment. And it's only when you have this historical perspective that you can see that there is a pattern. The events of 9/11 did not happen out of a historical context and also a political context. Look what unfolded immediately. They created the boogeyman. As Ralph has pointed out, this is the same boogeyman that was created time and time again. And 9/11 was critical to establishing a situation of permanent war. The war that is going on in Iraq, as originally General Shinseki had said, is going to be a long-term war. Already, the military expenditure is $300 billion and rising. And that is just for Iraq. And as the generals have now come forward and said recently in Washington, they are going to be there for year after year after year. It is important to have programs such as 9/11 and State Terror that put all the pieces together. 212 209-2950. You can't get the full picture listening only once. This is something like the classic works that you read and you read again, or you listen and you listen again, and you each time you absorb another element, another piece of the picture, and then you are empowered because you can express it yourself. 212-209-2950. This is what education is all about. And without WBAI, there wouldn't be an opportunity for us to be with you each week. We're here in California, and it's our hearts and our souls and our expression is with the people in the New York, the tri-state region, with you. 212-209-2950.
You know, I remember, Maya, when we were programming recently, information pertaining to the series of political assassinations that are so well known in this society, and I'm not talking about the hundreds, indeed thousands, of activists and militants who have been murdered in the course of the years and decades in the United States, but to take a figure such as Robert Kennedy, who was of the ruling class and acting on its behalf and nonetheless was eliminated. Instructive about that is that the agency that had been setting up the investigation of the Kennedy killing within the police department was called Special Unit Senator. And the two people who were in charge of that were Enrique Hank Hernandez and Manuel Pena, who we learned and who we documented and who we exposed were two principal figures in the death squads that the Central Intelligence Agency had been operating in Uruguay and in Argentina. That is the state terror apparatus. They investigate their own eliminations, and they put themselves in charge of the cover-up as well. It's the nature of the state under capitalism. It's the nature of the events that define our reality within our frontiers and without. When the Kennedy killing occurred, I'm talking now about John Kennedy, when John Kennedy was offed, and in what was, as the evidence overwhelmingly demonstrates, we showed in our programming Who Killed Kennedy and Why, a Central Intelligence Agency operation, Malcolm X said at that time, the chickens have come home to roost. And what Malcolm said was this: you can't have murder squads roaming the planet and think they're going to stop out at your national frontiers. So this is not only about the victimization of the target populations of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and the Middle East, it certainly is that, but it is above all a war against our own people, a war that is waged by the rapacious few to maintain a decadent system that is incapable of meeting elementary human needs. That is a perception supported by history. Every major public event is a way of elucidating that reality when you understand it, when you document it, when you explain it, when you analyze it. That's the job of Taking Aim. That's the role of Free Speech Radio. And we ask you to join in a partnership in that effort, brothers and sisters. Part of this process. This is not a spectator sport. We're in this together. We're in a struggle for survival for everything that we value, because this is a system so decadent, as Rosa Luxemburg said at the time of the First World War, a system of capital that must engage in constant war and imperial predation presents us with a choice between socialism and barbarism. Almost a century later, brothers and sisters, it's the same choice, and that's what we do. Elucidate that reality. We need your support.
212-209-2950, our premium 9/11 and state terror. And this is the presentation that Ralph made at the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11 Phase 2 that was held in Toronto. It's a two-CD set that includes the remarkable presentation, and then followed by a panel discussion engaging with Ralph on further issues of his presentation and question and answers from the very large audience in the auditorium. This is a $100 contribution to WBAI, your contribution for your own radio station, the radio station that belongs to you. Along with the premium, you have your membership in WBAI. If you are a member, this adds to the benefit of being a member. If you're not a member, this is the moment to subscribe and support your station, the station that comes to you 24 877-212-209-2950. And Ralph was also referring to the premium that we offered last week, also a two-CD set. That's Who Killed Kennedy and Why, about the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And along with that came a remarkable pamphlet on the Robert Kennedy assassination that he had written. It is now the time to remind you that this is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and it broadcasts to the tri-state region and over the internet at www.wbai.org. We're going to continue with further excerpts from Ralph's presentation, and then we'll be back with more discussion. And get to your phone during this, while we're playing a further excerpt, 212-209-2950. Keep the phones ringing, and we'll keep the program playing. Michael?
BBC had reported that hijacked suspects are alive and well. Those who we've been presented with as hijackers were, in fact, present elsewhere, in Casablanca, in various locations, alive and well. Abdulaziz Alomari, Ashok Al-Assad, listed as the hijacker in the United flight that crashed in Pennsylvania. The most cursory examination of the official fiction discloses what we really are looking at here. Many of you may remember that Fox TV News, Carl Cameron and Britt Hume, did a series of broadcasts about the role of Israeli intelligence. And it disclosed that all directory assistance calls and call records in the United States are now carried out by Amdocs, an Israeli company tied to Israeli intelligence. Indeed, the National Security Agency in Maryland noted that all sensitive calls in the U.S. are now in Israeli intelligence hands. There is an inseparable, functioning linkage between the highest echelons of the U.S. intelligence apparatus and those of the Mossad. Amdocs, Converse Information Systems, CALIA, the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement, all with a backdoor under control of the Mossad, as is disclosed here by Fox News in particular detail. But they proceed to document as well that 200 Mossad operatives were assigned to a series of tasks, including those in Hollywood, Florida, where they were monitoring those who we are told are training at flight schools. And they were located within three doors of Mohammed Atta, and they were in constant contact with him. And then there is the description of the urban moving system and the detained Israelis, in which the urban moving system was responsible for organizing the presence of Israeli military intelligence personnel in the hours preceding the attack on the World Trade Center, standing there with cameras to film the events prior to their unfolding and during, and subsequently detained and immediately released, and then, as they are surfacing again in Tel Aviv, being acknowledged as military intelligence and Mossad. New York Post amplifying on this. The stories the American media have not covered well, says Al Gart in the New York Post. The white van at Sears Tower in the Philadelphia Mercury. Israeli intelligence officials preparing to video Sears Tower, evidently anticipating that that was a target soon to be under attack. Le Monde, March 5, 2002. The vast Israeli spy apparatus that functions with U.S. intelligence throughout the United States. Yes, the hands of the Mossad are all over these events. Not long after 9/11, Arno de Borsgrave, who is the senior editor at the United Press International and a former editor of Newsweek and the Washington Times, conducted an interview with General Gul Hamid. Gul Hamid had been the head of the Pakistani ISI, the intelligence services, and the figure who is in fact responsible for facilitating on behalf of the Central Intelligence Agency the creation of what has become known as Al-Qaeda. Something like $30 billion processed through. Osama bin Laden and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the principal recipients thereof. And in the interview with Gulhamid, Arnold de Borsgrave was in for something of a surprise, because Gulhamid laid out for him, as he described it, what he called an inside job. Arnold de Borsgrave was incredulous, as Gulhamid stated, "I work for you people. This is a stand down. This is an operation of Israeli intelligence and the Air Force and intelligence services in the United States. The transponders are not accorded their due. There are no scrambling of jets immediately after the event. We know who benefits from this," he said. "U.S. intelligence agencies, the Israeli Mossad, those who have a stake in extending their reign throughout the Arab East, destabilizing the Central Asian Republic, seizing its oil." He laid it out in particularized detail, and he said, "I work for you guys. You trained me. Standard operation," he said. He was asked about Osama bin Laden. He said, "Are you serious? From a cave in Afghanistan? A few people who can't break wind without being monitored? Your intelligence agencies joke about the fact that they pass around the communications that are monitored. Every time they use a cell phone, every time they attempt to send any kind of communication." He said, "It's an inside job." And he particularized the reasons for that. Well, how many times have we been treated to the dramatic evidence of a new tape surfacing from Osama bin Laden? Shazam! More dangerous than 50,000 hydrogen bomb-bearing missiles, more menacing than the former Soviet Union, it's Osama bin Laden from his cave in Afghanistan. Do you remember the initial video that was released in which he was taking responsibility for the events of 9/11 and congratulating those who had partaken in those events? Hani Sibai, as reported by the BBC, an electronics expert in London, ascertained that we had here a classic scissors and paste job, in which a video of a wedding ceremony where Osama bin Laden was greeting those who were attending was married into the presentation with voice undiscernible in what was transparently a fabrication. But they kept at it. Every time there was a dramatic event that represented some kind of political problem for the rulers, out comes another tape from Osama bin Laden. The one with the paraplegic sheikh, you recall. Supposedly done during a visit to Osama bin Laden outside of Kandahar during the full moon of Ramadan. Well, the full moon did not occur during Ramadan. Osama bin Laden, however, did do an interview of some length, which appeared on the BBC and in a Pakistani publication called Umat. He said, "I have already stated that I have no involvement in the events of September 11th and the attacks in the United States. I had no knowledge of these attacks, nor do I consider the killing of innocent women, children, and other humans an appreciable act. There exists," he says, "a government within the government in the United States. That secret government must be asked as to who carried out these attacks. The United States should trace the perpetrators of these attacks to these persons who want to make the present century one of their own control, who want to enslave other countries." That is the assessment, and it's elaborated by Osama bin Laden without attempting to romanticize this figure. The fact of the matter is that if you look at the Umat interview, which is elaborated and given in person, there is little incentive for this man to disavow that which he is supposed to be dedicated to carrying through. There are similar characteristics to be found with respect to others of those accused. Let's take a look for a moment at Massawi, Zacharias Massawi. Now, interestingly enough, Zacharias Massawi is, we are told, a person who received some flying instruction while he was in Norman, Oklahoma, at a flight school there. Interestingly, we now learn that a man named Nicholas Berg was also at that flight school, and somehow Zacharias Massawi had obtained his computer password, which he was using as his own. Who do you think owned the flight school in Norman, Oklahoma, where Zacharias Massawi and Nicholas Berg were taking instruction? It was Warren Buffett. The same Warren Buffett who at 7 a.m. on the 11th of September, 2001, hosted a breakfast of CEOs with offices in the World Trade Center at the Offutt Air Force Base, the SAC Strategic Headquarters in Omaha, Nebraska. The same Warren Buffett, by the way, who is the chief economic advisor today to John Kerry, even as he had been for the Gruppenführer, as we call him in California, Arnold Schwarzenegger. So you see, brothers and sisters, the elements of control are apparent, and the authors of these events emerge. The hired hands, notwithstanding, the plug uglies are not the focus of our concern. They are the instruments, yes, but they carry out the will of those in power, and they do this at our expense, and their perpetration of these acts are not those of their own, but the implementation, if indeed they are involved in all, is apart from being covers and patsies on behalf of those who rule. False flag operations, the characteristic mode of the ruling order. How many times in the official hearings did you hear Condoleezza Rice and Kofor Black and Robert Mueller and Bob Kerry, the former senator from Nebraska, and the whole panoply of these people, Tom Kaine and so forth, talk about the history of Al-Qaeda and the series of crimes that they had perpetrated? Condoleezza Rice referred specifically to the Achille Lauro event. Do you remember the Achille Lauro? It was imputed to the Palestine Liberation Organization when a pleasure boat was hijacked, and at one point, an infirm Jewish man in a wheelchair, Leon Klinghoffer, was brutally thrown overboard. If you read the book Prophets of War by Ari Ben-Menashe, we learn that this was a Mossad operation of Rafi Eitan, imputed to the Palestinians through Abu Abbas, funded by Sicilian dons through the aegis of the Mossad. Chapter and verse. How many times in these official hearings was the embassy explosion in Nairobi invoked for us? Yes, Al-Qaeda, responsible for the blowing up of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi. The San Francisco Chronicle on 11-4-01, in an article by Lance Williams and Aaron McCormick, Ali Mohammed, Silicon Valley resident, planned the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi. For 15 years, a high-level FBI officer assigned to the training, no less, of Osama bin Laden's bodyguards in Afghanistan. For many years working with the Central Intelligence Agency, a long-standing operative, the events in Nairobi were the paradigm of the false flag operation. Haaretz documents how the Mossad had not just prior knowledge of that event. The blowing up of the embassy was long in the documented presentations of the Mossad in Israel. Ann Taylor in the Sydney Morning Herald, early warning on Kenya, Mossad foreknowledge of November 28th, and the Mombasa attacks as well. Questions mount. This is not particular to the blowing up of the embassy in Nairobi. The Pentagon attack that killed 125 people, exclusive. Newsweek has learned that the hijackers had a close relationship with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Newsweek 9/16/02. The Daily Telegraph in London, June 23rd, 2003, bringing down the Brooklyn Bridge. the American Al-Qaeda operative unmasked last week of planning to bring down the Brooklyn Bridge was an FBI agent for years. What about the U.S. coal, invoked again by Condoleezza Rice and Robert Mueller and George Tenet and Kofor Black? The C4 explosives had a fingerprint, not unlike the anthrax that was documented in New Scientist in London, with the telltale fingerprint of a militarized and weaponized form of anthrax that comes from U.S. military labs. So it is with the C4 explosives coming right from Israeli and American military arsenal, as the Middle East Monitor laid out and documented for us. Operation Trojan. In Operation Trojan, the former colonel in the Mossad, Viktor Ostrovsky, in his book The Other Side of Deception, lays out how the Mossad located transmitter devices three buildings away from the headquarters of Muammar Gaddafi, sending out signals to embassies across the world about planned assassinations and terror attacks, such as the blowing up of the Lebel discotheque in Berlin. Well, the Lebel discotheque was blown up in Berlin, and it was exposed by German television as a Mossad operation in Zweite Deutsche Fernschaft and in Frontal. Chapter and verse, a false flag operation. Many of you may recall Pan Am 103. Remember how that was ascribed to the Libyans once again. Well, in fact, the story of Pan Am 103 is particularly instructive, and the Canadian press has played a seminal role in documenting what in fact occurred. There is an organization known as Interforce in New York. It consists of former Mossad and Shin Bet and DIA and CIA and German intelligence operatives who have gone private. They hire out their services. The insurance company representing Pan Am was confronted by a huge liability prospect from the family members of those who died in Pan Am 103. And they retained Interforce, who did a very extended and detailed inquiry into what were the dynamics of Pan Am 103. And what they established was the following: that in a series of intelligence operations across the Arab East, where the Drug Enforcement Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States was engaged in heroin smuggling into the United States on behalf of the U.S. government, a number of their operatives were being taken out. As often happens with these operatives, on a need-to-know basis, they are considered both expendable and a risk. And a series of these, six of them, were coming in from the cold on Pan Am 103. And what was discerned and what was documented in this report was that the explosives were put on board by the Central Intelligence Agency in Frankfurt, and these figures were taken out. And all the particular details of this, the president of Pan Am said, "I thought I was running an airline and not a drug smuggling operation for the Central Intelligence Agency," quote unquote. By the way, that full report of Interforce was given to one person in Congress, the congressman from Ohio, James Traficant. He's the only man who actually read it into the congressional record and asked for some inquiry about the events. And as you're well aware, shortly thereafter, he was drummed out of the Congress of the United States on the basis that he had been taking bribes. Well, the John Picton in the Toronto Star and Barron's, the financial publication, laid out all of the evidence about the role of intelligence agencies, namely the CIA and the DEA, in these events. And they documented as well that this was not the first time that at Gander in Newfoundland, a similar flight had crashed, bringing in people nominally from U.S. bases in Germany. And once again, the same scenario, intelligence operatives taken out in the downing of a flight because they were coming out, they were coming in from the cold. False flag operations, the paradigm. So what are we looking at here? With the events of 9/11, we are told that the evil instrument of terror, Al-Qaeda, has metastasized. It's everywhere now. The events of Madrid. Once again, Al-Qaeda. Not only Al-Qaeda. Remarkably, on February 29th of this year, the Madrid publication El País ran a story which disclosed that 9/11 itself was prepared by Mohammed Atta and his roommate, Zarqas, in the Spanish city of Tarragona. And that an event of like kind can be anticipated in Madrid, very prescient. Of course, the chief editor of that publication is in the Council of Foreign Relations and an associate of Henry Peterson, its head, and they had taken out a mortgage, as it turns out, on Building 7 at the World Trade Center. Zarqas and Zugam, those to whom the events of Madrid were imputed, had indeed been arrested at the time of 9/11 and released because of insufficient evidence. And then after the bombing in Casablanca, detained again and released again for lack of evidence. And monitored thereafter by the intelligence agencies. They could not go out of their house or buy a hot dog without their movements being recorded. And yet, they were very clever folk. They managed to put detonating explosives under the carriages of 10 railroad cars in Madrid while they were under security in the station. Not using cell phones. The physical evidence doesn't compute. Those bombs blew the floors out from those carriages through the roof. Well, the events in Madrid were preceded by something called Operation Gladio that had unfolded in Italy over a period of 40 years. If you read a book by Philip Willen called The Puppet Master and a series of articles in The Guardian, we find that for a space of 40 years, the Central Intelligence Agency and Italian intelligence carried out a series of official acts of terror across Italy. Often under the name of the Red Brigade, totally penetrated in an organization called P2 that embraced the official Italian intelligence services under the direction of each director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Ad Siriadum. The kidnapping of Aldo Moro and his subsequent murder, imputed to the Red Brigade, another example of that. The blowing up of the train station in Bologna, almost a model for the way in which it unfolded in Madrid. You know, in the aftermath of Madrid, it was expected, after all, that an event of this character would frighten and intimidate the Spanish population, 90% of whom had been passionately opposed to the war in Iraq and the presence of Spanish troops in that occupation. Clearly, the intent was to frighten and intimidate people into accepting the Aznar Francoist regime. The Spanish masses revolted. They may have chosen a blunt instrument in the regime of Zapatero, but they did not accept the official fiction. And Newsweek reports that there was panic in Washington as a consequence. And what has been the response? DEPCA, once again, the Israeli intelligence services, have proceeded to inform us, as I mentioned before, that Madrid demonstrates that Al-Qaeda has metastasized. It is all over Europe now. There are 45,000 operatives in France, 15,000 in Great Britain, 30,000 in Berlin. They are preparing events that will dwarf those of Madrid and 9/11. Sir John Stevenson, the Commissioner, High Commissioner of Police in London, it is inevitable an event of Madrid size will occur in London, and New York is next. Every single major instrument of communication has orchestrated this theme. You remember the piece in Cigar Aficionado by Tommy Franks, in which he anticipates the inevitability of a next attack to be followed by the suspension of the Constitution and the imposition of martial law by demand, by popular demand. William Rothkopf in the Washington Post, the inevitable attack that will require the cancellation of the elections in 2004. William Arkin in the Los Angeles Times, USA Today, Newsweek, Newsday, Agence France-Presse, New Zealand Press, across the world, this constant theme and motif, the inevitability of the next attack. Biological weapons, chemical weapons, suitcase nukes, they are inevitable, they are inexorable. And then in March, Atlantic Monthly, with a seminal piece called The Armageddon Plan, disclosing that since 1980, there has been preparation for the seizure of control by national security and military personnel who have been rehearsing at least twice a year in hardened bunkers. Congress suspended permanently, the Constitution, forget it. The point men, according to the piece in the Atlantic Monthly, Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney since 1980, and then Ted Koppel on ABC Nightline treating us to a presentation of the Armageddon Plan with Richard Clark present and Edwin Meese, as they unfold how it is inevitably going to be required as the next terror attack presents itself. They are unable to rule without terrorizing our people. They cannot sustain their imperial predation without resort to the terror state maneuvers that 9/11 express so clearly. And they are relentless in informing us that this is inevitable and is only a matter of when, not if. And Hillary Clinton joins with Lindsey Graham, the Republican senator from South Carolina, in calling for an increase of troops in occupied Iraq up to 200,000. And John Kerry tells us that it's not only necessary to increase those troops, but to prepare for the next events and to begin the process of detaining people before they commit acts, says Mr. Kerry. This is a system so degenerate and so decomposed that it is incapable of meeting the most elementary needs of human beings. They are cannibalizing the infrastructure of our society. On the eve of 9/11, on September 10th, Dan Rather reported on CBS News that $2.3 trillion had disappeared from the Pentagon's funds. And Robert J. Lieberman, for the General Accounting Office and for the accounting for the Defense Department's allocations, testified that, in fact, it was something like $7.6 trillion, for which there is no proper accounting. $4.4 trillion had no paper trail whatsoever. Cooking the books. Disappearing this into offshore numbered accounts. The apparatus of the murder state. As I've mentioned, the $1 trillion is $1,000 a minute since the birth of Jesus. This is not a system capable of meeting the most elementary needs of our people. They are waging class war. They are taking away everything for which people have struggled for the past 100 years. Our health care, our housing, our libraries, our schools. Recently, the longshore workers, Local 5, in San Francisco, legendary for having shut down the ports in opposition to apartheid, in defense of the struggle in Central America, issued a call for a million worker march on Washington on October 16th. And in that mission statement, they declared that the time has come for working people, the overwhelming majority of the population in our society, to put forward our demands and our needs and to answer the summons of Martin Luther King 36 years before, when he called for a poor people's march on Washington and declaimed that the most vicious purveyor of violence on the planet were the authorities in control of the government in the United States. And since that time, the entire Longshore Division from San Diego to Anchorage has endorsed, and the Teamsters Black Caucus has endorsed, and labor councils across the United States have endorsed, and the communication workers in local after local have endorsed, and the public worker sector, AFSCME, has endorsed, and the International Association of Machinists has endorsed, and the International Action Committee that organized the mass demonstrations in Washington has endorsed, and there is a movement, brothers and sisters, of people determined to fight back. And it is stated in the mission statement that we intend to confront those in power with our own demands. Because remember, for all this concentrated power and all the perfidies that 9/11 represent and all of the series of operations that they are premising and promising us, they are an isolated handful of people. Their power rests on an acquiescence that is precarious and impermanent. No, it is not the evil which is new, nor is it the crisis that has changed. It is rather that this generation is confronted by the same structure of power and the same rapacious form of rule and the same deceitful methods of imposing its will as those who have preceded us. And what lessons do we learn from this, brothers and sisters? You can't persuade them. You can't influence them. You cannot change them and you cannot contain them. We have to build that movement to remove them, to overthrow them. And as the longshore workers said so well, the moment of trial is always, and now is the appointed time. Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to 9/11 and State Terror, the presentation by Ralph Schoenman at the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11 Phase 2 that took place in Toronto last year, May 25th through 30th. It is part of a 2-CD presentation that includes Ralph's presentation, a panel discussion afterwards with the 3-person panel asking Ralph further questions and his amplifying on many of the issues that he discusses in this presentation, and also a question and answer period from the very large and vocal audience, sophisticated audience, about the events of 9/11 that took place after the panel's interaction with Ralph. This is 2CD. It's a $100 contribution to WBAI, our listener-sponsored radio station, Free Speech Radio, where you can only find presentations such as 9/11 and State Terror. I'm Maya Schoen, and this is Ralph Schoenman, who's here with me, and we're coming to you from Vallejo, California, through the telephone lines. Normally, we're in the studios at KPFA, coming via the ISDN line, the high-speed transmission line, which costs a great deal of money for WBAI to maintain, with Taking Aim every week from 5 to 6 p.m. on Tuesdays. We're glad to meet all of you who are listening at this time, and we hope that you get on the phones now, 212-209-2950. This is your only opportunity for 9/11 and State Terror. You know, you're going to regret, absolutely regret, not having this presentation, this remarkable event that took place in Toronto over 5 days, and Ralph's presentation was a highlight of this remarkable inquiry. This was not like the charade that took place in Congress. This was an actual methodical inquiry, and Ralph puts the events in historical perspective and gives you a lot of detail. 9/11 and State Terror. 212-209-2950.
It does attempt to show that the ongoing events, Maya, not just those of 9/11 itself, but what preceded it and what follows from it, are part of a consistent pattern. And I think when we step back and we look at these phenomena in their context, that we begin to see how they really play out. That's what this inquiry was really setting itself the task of accomplishing. I think it went a long way towards doing that. It's an ongoing pursuit. All of us are engaged in it. But we need the support of our listeners to maintain this programming, to support WBAI, to support Taking Aim, to support the inquiry and the analysis that we present in 9/11 and the terror state.
You know, Ralph, without the terror apparatus that was initiated with the events of 9/11, the attacks on the World Trade Center, the conspiracy of elements of the U.S. government that created this event, how else could they rationalize the hundreds of billions of dollars that have gone in for the permanent war, the attacks in the Middle East and in Afghanistan? How else could they initiate the control over what we read in the libraries? It just happened recently where librarians in one state had to object to the FBI coming in and saying that they wanted to know the names, the addresses, the telephone numbers of everybody that had ever taken out a book that was a biography of Osama bin Laden.
Well, we've done programming called Testing the Waters, martial law in the United States, and the terror state and 9/11 have provided the climate not just for the Patriot Act, brothers and sisters, but for the militarization of the police and for setting up under the Northern Command and other central instruments of the military's control over this continent the means for literally martial law, because the the justifications for 9/11 itself, the implementation of this false flag operation, go along with an apparatus for controlling the population as the acquiescence and consent on which they the authorities rely disappears before their very eyes. They're taking away our health care, they're taking away our pensions, the housing infrastructure is destroyed, the schools are being dismantled, all of the social requirements of a decent life are being literally destroyed in the United States to feed the military maw, and the authorities know that they have a limited run before there is popular revolt. That's what the martial law state is designed to meet. That's why it is not, as we say, a spectator sport. We're vitally involved. The unfolding events are not only in Iraq, but within our national frontiers. Please keep the radio programming going that can understand, analyze, and arm us with information that will allow the resistance to build and the movement to become an overwhelming reality that will transform this country in the ways that are necessary for our survival.
It is only on a station such as WBAI that you've been hearing 9/11 in state terror, 212-209-2950, and it's only on a station such as WBAI and with your incredible support that we could have done a six-part series creating the next pandemic and followed it up with orchestrating the big lie, the rice and poison plot, their most recent series of programs on taking aim. And in creating the next pandemic, as Julie Gerberding, the director of the CDC, was saying, it's not a question of if, but when there was going to be a massive biological pandemic in the United States. But what she didn't say is that the United States government is funding in academic and in military labs across the United States the manipulation of viruses, which would create the next pandemic. That it is the state itself that is creating these pandemics and these terrible viruses. And again, this creates a sense of terror, just as 9/11. These are not isolated or unpredictable events. These are events that are part and parcel of the capitalist state and of maintaining a rule over us. And it's only with information analysis and, most importantly, coherent analysis that we can organize our resistance, that we can have a life that is that is to our interest and not to the interest of the rulers. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950 for this two-CD set, Ralph Schoenman's presentation at the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11, Phase 2, 9/11 and State Terror. Ralph?
Keep it going, brothers and sisters. This programming is in your hands. WBAI, taking aim, 9/11 and the terror state, the analysis, the information, it depends on you. Support us. Call in 212-209-2950. Please pledge for this presentation. Keep the programming going. That's your responsibility to meet the responsibility that those who work at WBI are undertaking every day. Please keep it going, brothers and sisters.
Michael, are you there?
I'm right here.
And
Yes, we do have some listeners to thank, people who have taken out subscriptions in WBAI, who've gotten the 9/11 package that you have made available to them this afternoon. 212-209-2950. What happens is that we have a number of people calling in for these packages, and they're writing very, very furiously to get the information down, and we're trying to get the cards back up here in the control room and read the names as quickly as possible. And in fact, I just caught this caller from Great Neck Village, New York, didn't want their name mentioned, so we won't do that. We'll honor that. But William Anderson from the Bronx, thank you very much, William, for your pledge of support. Rita Rofe from Princeton, New York, called in with a pledge of support. And this cannot be Princeton, New York, because of the zip code. It is 08, so that is Princeton. Let me make this correction. Princeton, New Jersey. Princeton, New Jersey. Thank you, Rita, very much. 212-209-2950. Jesse Queen from Brooklyn. Thank you very much, Jesse. Ribbon Pomo from Ridgewood, New York. Thank you very much. 212-209-2950. Mark Boley from New Rochelle called in with a pledge of support to WBAI. Betsy Amin Arsala from Washington, D.C., visiting us on the web at WBAI.org. Thank you, Betsy, so much for your pledge of support. Mohammed Hack from New Hyde Park, New York. Thank you very much. You're listening to a special edition of Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. Coming up at 3 p.m. will be a special edition of Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton. Steve Berlin from Wantagh, New York. Thank you very much. Steve Lloyd Houcher from Brooklyn, New York. Thank you very much. John D'Ambrosio from Kearney, New Jersey. Thank you very much. Robert Soper from the Bronx. Thank you very much. Robert Zachary Dowdy from Baldwin, New York. Hugh Johnson from Brooklyn. We have some more cards here calling in for this Taking Aim special. 9/11 and State Terror, the two CD package for a pledge of $100. And by the way, you can become a member of WBAI at the $25 level, being this listener-supported radio station. Over 40 years, this station has been listener-sponsored and commercial-free. That is why we can bring you a program like Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. Samuel L. Let's check that. That says no, so Samuel. All right, fine. Ali Abdul Jarmin from Jamaica, New York. Thank you very much. Caller from New York City. Thank you very much. Helga Halaki from New York City. And a caller from Brooklyn, New York. Thank you very much. Another caller from Spring Valley, New York. Janet Akulian from New York City. Thank you all very, very much for calling in and pledging for Taking Aim here on WBAI at 99.5 FM and also available on the web at WBAI.org. 9/11 and State Terror. Maya?
Yes, Michael, I'd like to remind people that our website is www.takingaim.info. And if you're new to hearing Ralph and me, we're on Tuesdays from 5 to 6, and we maintain an archive of our past programs at www.takingaim.info, and that is prepared by Mark Bilt. We want to extend our thanks to Mark and to all the people who contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net with information that finds its way into our programs, and for your questions and your comments. And Pamela Summers also deserves a wonderful thanks for setting up our website and maintaining it.
Thank you very much, Pamela.
Years. Mm-hmm. So Pamela and Mark and Michael and Kathy Davis, who has given us so much support, the public affairs director, and each week assists us with our transmission. So it takes a team of people to prepare Taking Aim, and you are part. You are part of our team, and part of the WBAI family and the team of WBAI. WBAI is providing a service for you. You are part of that service. And as Michael said, WBAI is commercial-free. And it is incredible. You cannot prepare a program such as Taking Aim on a commercial station where every 6 minutes or every 5 minutes your thought is interrupted. You can't follow the concept. You can't provide the analysis and the data. And also, when you do have an interruption for a commercial, you have to structure your show where there's a moment of high drama so that people have the idea of coming back to listen to you. So it's a terrible disruption of the mind and also of the analysis.
Well, that's only the mechanics, of course, and I think our listeners are well aware that Pepsodent is not interested in the events of 9/11. That the official media are, you know, I can tell you, I was on a show, a TV program locally called Like It Is with Gil Noble, and we were discussing how the Emir of Kuwait had $2.3 trillion in U.S. and European banks, and we were walking through how the U.S. had long targeted the resources, along with the Israelis, of Kuwait, And the show was, we were broadcasting for an hour and a half, and suddenly the signal cut off, and the TV show on ABC Network went to black, and they didn't even cut to a commercial. Now, Gil Noble went upstairs to say to the ABC execs, "Hey, is this like it is or like you want it to be? I've never had this happen." And I wrote them a letter, and I asked for an explanation, and I was then told that I was taking facts and events out of context. So I wrote back and I said, "The Emir of Kuwait has bought Capital Industries that owns ABC Television. How's that for context?" Well, that's the context, brothers and sisters. The commercial media, the established corporate media, are integrated within the national security state. They're part of the banking and corporate capital and the very flight capital of the instruments of imperial rule. That's why WBAI is the healthy answer. It's the people's answer. It's free speech radio. It is not purchased by Pepsodent. It is not subject to the control of the terror state itself. You need to keep it going, brothers and sisters. We're all part of this together. Please call your pledge in. Keep this support going. 212-209-2950.
And as a reminder, this is 9/11 and state terror. Two CD... wonderfully edited presentation, edited by Bonnie Faulkner of Guns and Butter, who doesn't let a breath remain. So it is a very intense presentation of the Ralph's 9/11 and State Terror at the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11 Phase 2. That was in Toronto. It includes the presentation plus a panel discussion with three intelligent people very knowledgeable about 9/11 and furthering the inquiry with Ralph, and then the sophisticated audience, a very large audience in the auditorium, with their questions for Ralph and his response. 2 CD, 9/11 and State Terror, $100 contribution.
It's a two-hour presentation and exchange, brothers and sisters. And I
only hear excerpts here today. 212-209-2950. We're here in California. We can't see or hear the phones ringing. We're looking for your support, and we hope you are going to your phone. 212-209-2950. You're going to regret it if you miss out on this, and we no regrets. Take action now. 212-209-2950. When I'm off the phone, I'm going into San Francisco, where I work for a labor union, professional and technical engineers, Local 21, and we're in a struggle to maintain seniority and the civil service rights of our members. And this is happening in city after city and state after state in California. It was only the concerted effort of the labor union members that beat back the attempts by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to destroy the pension system for public sector workers. And it is only when we band together, when we defend our own interests together, that we become powerful. And that's what it means also at WBAI to have this station. It is our collective effort, and this is the moment of your contribution to keep this station on the air. If it weren't here, you would regret it. And if you didn't have programs such as Taking Aim and 9/11 and State Terror, you would regret it. So don't take us for granted, and don't take WBAI for granted. Get to the phone, 212-209-2950. Often people do take for granted that we're going to be on every week. They take for granted that our shows will be up on the archive. But it's all done by volunteers, and we need your contributions to sustain it, your contribution to make WBAI a viable, efficient, and effective broadcast medium. 212-209-2950.
History proceeds. What happens in the future, brothers and sisters? The events of 9/11 are not isolated from what's unfolding before us today. As you know, they're promising us a pandemic. They're promising us a biological attack every minute of every day. Some other medium tells us that it's inevitable. And when we analyze that, as we do on Taking Aim in the six-part series, Creating the Next Pandemic, we find that these entire biological arsenal of viruses that have been mutated with recombinant genes are part of the militarization and weaponization of biological viruses, and with the precise intent of inducing endemic pandemics across the planet. It's a terrifying scenario, and yet it is rooted in a reality, and it is part of what we try to explain, to elucidate the nature of the terror state. You know, what is the reality, brothers and sisters? There's a greater disparity of wealth. I mean, the UN, UNESCO has just come out with a report that over 1 billion children, over half the children in the world, are living at starvation level. This is a system incapable of meeting the elementary needs of people. And in order to maintain its control, it affects a terror state to dominate, to bewilder, to cow, to demoralize, to undermine, and to atomize. And that is, in fact, the real underlying context of 9/11. It's the context of the pandemics that they are constantly promoting. And it is a context of the dominance of the few, that 1% controls 95% of the national wealth. We have only 5% of the world's population within our frontiers, and yet this tiny oligarchy controls almost 70% of the world's natural resources. By any criterion, that's an empire. It's a rapacious empire. It requires military control, martial law devices, and terrorizing the population of our country. Our programming is designed to expose this, to inform about it, and to prepare us for the resistance to it. Please support it. 212-209-2950. Get this 2-hour presentation of 9/11 and the terror state. Call 212-209-2950.
Michael?
Yes, Maya and Ralph, would you please give your website information out again? Because, you know, as we said for the past hour or more, this is not your usual time. And I must say, the listeners of this time have really responded very, very well, and we're very encouraged by that. But give the website out and the other information so that people who do not usually hear you at this hour can get in contact with you.
Okay, Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. This is our fourth year on WBAI. We're on Tuesdays from 5 to 6 p.m., and the show is streamed at www.wbai.org. If you miss it, if you're on the subway or in your car and unable to hear the entire show, we maintain an archive of programs. It doesn't go back to the very beginning, but it starts in August of 2002. And the archive is at www.takingaim.info. Info for the information that we provide, takingaim.info, and you can reach us by email at takingaim@pacbell, that's P-A-C-B-E-L-L .net, or takingaim@wbai.org, and we look forward to hearing from you. You can also telephone us at 707-552-9995. And, Michael, thanks again for assisting us and bringing us the listeners that we want to thank. We want to thank each and every one of you who's made a contribution to WBAI while we've been on the air. And we hope that you will continue. You can make a contribution via the secure web online system, www.wbai.org, and keep calling even after we're off the air.
You can call us once again at 707-552-9995. We'd like to hear from our listeners. We continue to get in. And by the way, brothers and sisters, send us information. People are continuously providing us with information and with sources that we ourselves had no knowledge of. it's a reciprocal enterprise, and we welcome your support and your participation in it.